Welcome to this episode of Accounting Stories. My guest of today is Ronald de Jong. Ronald is the Distinguished Professor of Practice in Business at Tilburg University. He had a career at Philips spanning almost 30 years. For the last 9 years, he was a member of the Executive Committee of Philips. He is also the founder of the Philips Foundation and chaired this foundation for about 10 years. His mission is to share some of the lessons he has learned in life to drive a more lasting positive impact and to help address the big societal challenges of our time. Ronald, how are you doing today?
Doing fine, Bart. Good afternoon. It's really a pleasure to be your guest this afternoon.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to this podcast. This is to this episode. It's an episode that we also do in the context of the course Global Sustainable Leadership. We'll talk more about that in a minute. So, really looking forward to this. So, did you have a good start of 2024?
Personally, I had a good start of the year after a very busy year end, where we had to finalize quite some things. I took it easy in the beginning of January. I went to the beach and took some time there to prepare the lectures for this coming semester. We will come to talk about the course, Global Sustainable Leadership. But I did that in relative peace. So that was a very nice opportunity to get started into the new year.
So, I'm curious, what does it mean for you preparing for the lectures? What is it like? A lot of like reading or writing or what?
It is a combination of reading, studying, reflecting upon the content that I consume. But then I also adapt the materials for the course. When you talk about the type of lectures that I give, I hardly ever give twice the same lecture, content-wise. Mm-hmm. So there is a red thread, there are themes, common topics, but so much is happening in the world today that impacts the field of interest of mine that I really take a point out of updating the content of my lectures to make sure that those also for students, they are actual.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about that in this podcast. So you also, if I remember correctly, you stopped as the chair of the Philips Foundation.
Yeah.
What does that mean? You have plenty of time now, or did you already fill that up with other stuff?
Well, when I started the Philips Foundation back in 2014, we put in the Articles of Association that there would be a maximum number of terms for all board members, and that also goes for me as a chairman. So it was time to hand over. I also think that that was healthy after 10 years to have a fresh pair of eyes. But I'm very busy with other things as well, so I will not be bored. I like what I'm doing at the university, but I'm also a member of the Advisory Council on International Affairs, which is the body that advises the Dutch government on foreign affairs, and also that keeps me quite busy.
Yeah, I can imagine, because there's like a lot of things happening on the international scene. I can imagine they need good advisors. Let's maybe jump into the first topic of today, which is like what we labeled like sustainability challenges. So to give it like a proper introduction, in your work as a professor here at this university and also in your advisory supervisory roles, so you help to address organizations to address the big challenges of our time. I think also if I'm looking backwards, the last decade, there's quite some progress on how firms look at these challenges and sustainability and how to deal with that. I think if I see the conversations I have with students these days compared to 10 years ago, that's like completely different. Meaning like 10 years ago, it was like, you know, what is sustainability? Is it really something, you know, it's charity, we don't have to pay attention to it. And these days it's more like, how do we have to do it in a firm? I think firms are also making progress, but correct me if I'm wrong, but we still see that it's maybe not going fast enough. Okay. I think the good thing is they pay attention to it more and more. It could maybe go faster. So how is your view on that? Like, do you think we are going fast enough? And if not, what are reasons why, why it's maybe not going fast enough, or why it's not going faster than what we would hope for.
Yeah, to reflect upon what you say, Bart, I think we face tremendous challenges as a society. And I think we have come to the recognition that all actors in society have a role to play in terms of addressing these challenges. That explicitly also includes businesses. Mm-hmm. Given the magnitude of the task at hand and the complexity of those challenges, we will never be able to say in the time that you and I will live that we are going fast enough. So I think that the task at hand is enormous. The complexity is tremendous, and we need to speed up. All actors in society need to speed up. That includes business. I do agree that there is more awareness. I do agree that there is more interest. There is probably not enough action. And what is even more important is what is then the tangible impact that we see in terms of addressing these challenges. In my view, there are a couple of reasons that cause the fact that we don't have the progress that we need. First of all, we need to recognize that we are basically coming out of an era where the purpose of business was really generally perceived to be the creation of financial value for the shareholders, for the owners of the company. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it, my personal view, and I'm on purpose a bit provocative, is that we realize shareholder value creation by converting social capital and natural capital into financial capital. And we have done in the last 200 years a tremendous job at that. I mean, unprecedented in the history of mankind. But we have been creating that value at the expense of the environment, at the expense of social justice, at the expense of the climate. To change that into a focus from creating financial value by converting social capital and natural capital into financial capital into what is called creating shared value, a theory that was formulated by, amongst others, Kramer and Porter from Harvard, is far more difficult. So companies had a sole focus, and I exaggerating a bit, on the creation of shareholder value, and now they are called to the task to create social value and ecological value and financial value and do that simultaneously. Yeah. That is hard. I think the second...
So can I maybe ask a question here? Okay, I think it's hard. I'm as an academic, like, okay, I want to understand why is it hard, and I'm talking with like quite a lot of managers, and I'm sure you also do. You have been in those boardrooms. So is that because social value and environmental value is not well measured? No? Because we don't measure it, so we are not aware of it, so managers cannot include it in their decision making. Is that one of the drivers why it is so hard, or is it just like a sole focus on short-term financial value? And I'm pretty sure you know it's a matter of both, but just what's your view on those?
There are a multitude of reasons, but yeah. I think the fact that we still lack standards and clear definitions that are broadly shared is for sure a factor. The fact that we also see differences between geographies is a problem. And so Europe tends to be far more advanced compared to some other parts of the world, but we are living in a globalized economy, and most companies compete on a global scale. So the level playing field argument is very often used and misused. But I think one of the real things that we see is that focusing on one thing and making sure that all your systems, processes, ways of working are tuned to help you make progress versus, in this case, your financial goal, is easier than starting with defining social targets and ecological targets, non-standardized, non-harmonized. Your ways of working are not tuned to give you the data. And then the biggest issue, and that's why you also see that we even see some backlash in the United States as we speak, is that the financial world tends to be a bit hypocrite as well. So we demand companies to take more responsibility for social issues and environmental issues. But my view would be that that is fine as long as it doesn't go at the expense of delivering the financial result.
Yeah.
And we see examples of companies in recent times where we had very progressive CEOs who embraced sustainability and ESG, which we will come to talk about, but failed to live up to the expectations of shareholders. And you see that then the patience of shareholders and the support of analysts is backing down a bit. So it's a multitude of issues. If you really want to have one common denominator in all of this, it's a bit of a hobby horse of mine that I will write in the course of this podcast.
Yeah.
It has a lot to do with purposeful and responsible leadership.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when I when it comes about like the what you mentioned, like those firms where CEOs are really purpose driven, and then quite some of them got fired the last, let's say, 2 years. And there, what you often see is then, you know, what shareholders do is they compare with like a peer group of other firms, often like firms that have a totally different business model. Especially in the energy sector, you see that, you know, you have the firms that focus more on green energy, and then the ones that still try to extract as much as value out of the brown like energy types. Well, we know from the green energy, it takes somewhat more time to generate like financial value out of that. So they have a longer horizon. If you compare, of course, these green energy firms with the brown energy firms, well, that's also an unfair comparison. And there, I think you see that it's so important to make the right choices and also how you evaluate performance. And my experience is that it often already goes wrong there, that shareholders are not yet fully aware what it means to invest in green technologies.
Well, the promise has been, and we as academics have also been researching that and validating that and teaching that, that if you embrace ESG and sustainability, that it will go hand in hand with value creation in financial terms that might even be superior to companies that don't embrace sustainability in ESG. For a variety of reasons, we might have to recalibrate that assumption and that promise and that expectation. I think that is partly also kicking in as we speak.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is the timing factor, rightfully so. Companies are very often driven by optimizing quarterly results and annual results, and we know that the big transitions of these times take years and maybe even decades. But the more fundamental question is the assumption that we can continue to increase earnings and earnings per share year after year ad infinitum, whether that assumption that economists like is a valid assumption, or will the big transitions of our time also go with pain? And are we willing to state that as leaders and make clear what the consequences are of going through these transitions for shareholders in terms of making long-term investments, for consumers because they might have to pay a higher price for a certain period of time? We as human beings are not very good at taking pain.
Yeah, that's true.
And ESG and sustainability was very popular in a time that we said, well, if you embrace sustainability, you will get an advantage in the labor market. You will be able to attract and retain talent. You will be able to attract and retain investors. Mm-hmm. You will deliver superior returns for your shareholders. If that, for a variety of reasons, becomes uncertain, then you see big capital backing off. And let's face it, I mean, companies that are very often also stock listed have to respond to the financial market.
Yeah. Yeah, I sometimes experience in companies that some of them are not even aware what are the trade-offs that we are making now in implementing this purpose-driven strategy. It's financial value compared to maybe something else. And so I think already making, as a CEO, making clear, okay, what are the trade-offs that we are about to make here? Which trade-offs do we have to make? That is already a big step. And I think the last couple of years have been like a growing economy, then there's less need to make those trade-offs clear. But now it's becoming more difficult. So what are the trade-offs that we really face here? Maybe a little bit less financial value, but well, in the short term and something else that helps us, like environmental social value. And that would also already be a big step, I think.
Well, I think the question is very fundamental. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we look at the life expectancy of big corporations and you go back 50 years in time, if you were an S&P 500 company 50 years ago, you would have an average life expectancy of around 60 years. Today, the number is about 18 years, and it is going down all the time.
Yeah.
So the question is, what do companies need to do to ensure their long-term relevance and therewith their long-term existence? In my book, they cannot secure their long-term existence if they are not becoming part of the solution in addressing some of the big challenges of our time.
Yeah.
I only think that the promise that that will go hand in hand with superior shareholder returns, so everybody will be happy, it will come at no cost for nobody, might have to be rethought.
Yeah.
And we need good leaders, strong leaders, who have the insight to share that and the ability to create support for measures that even on the short term might hurt the perceived interest of certain stakeholders.
Okay. That's clear.
And we don't have a lot of those leaders.
Not yet, but we are training them, I think. Okay, good. So that was the first reason. What was then the second reason that you see or that you experienced?
Well, I think implicitly we mentioned three reasons. Huh? I think one of the things that I said is the shareholder value thing has been dominant and we need to make the turn to creating shared value, and that's more complicated. Mm-hmm. And you challenged me on that and we discussed that.
Yeah.
I think the second thing is that the fact that we live in a globalized economy means that you cannot drive sustainability agendas in geographical isolation.
Mm-hmm.
If Europe would be very straight and committed to ESG and other parts of the world would not be, and you operate in that globalized economy, you have an issue. Because you might lose your competitiveness. And the third one is that the leadership needed, and we closed off our discussion on that note, to really also tell difficult stories.
Yeah.
Not only positive stories, but difficult stories. You see it in politics. You see it in business as well, where you make clear that the transition will go with pain,
mm-hmm.
and we need to divide the pain in a certain fashion. It's a difficult message to convey, and many leaders avoid telling that message.
Yeah.
Now, on the more, let's say, simple side or the enabler side, and you referred to that in the beginning, for sure it would help if there would be a standardized set of definitions and a globally agreed framework with which we could measure the degree to which companies would live up to sustainability and ESG commitments, if that would be applicable globally. So for everybody, all of those things would help. I mean, I think norms, standards, definitions is something where next to all of the consultants and the accounting companies,
mm-hmm.
Also the academic world has a role to play.
Yeah.
Is playing that role as well, but also sees it as a field where there is competition between academics and between accounting companies and between regulating bodies. And that is not helping because it leads to a multitude of standards and that leads to confusion.
Yeah, but we have like the CSRD now in Europe. What is your view on that?
I think the CSRD is a very good attempt to harmonize and standardize in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
The criticism that you get is that arguably CSRD is more strict in terms of what you expect companies to live up to compared to, for instance, Asia or the United States.
Yeah.
And for that reason, companies that are competing not only in Europe, but also outside of Europe and face competition from US companies or Asian companies have an issue with CSRD.
Yeah.
And use it as an argument why they might have to reconsider where they put their headquarters or where they put their priorities in terms of investments and what have you.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's definitely true, and I think that's a kind of weakness of the CSRD that it's Europe based. When it comes to that, explaining the transition, when I have classes with my students, whether it are first year students or master students or executives, whatever, and then you let them play a game, and now at the end they have to explain the to like a group of shareholders the outcomes of the game. And in that game, they have to make decisions where sustainability plays a role. Then they really find it difficult to explain the trade-off that they made. Like, why have you taken these type of decisions? And that comes a little bit to your point, like, you know, explain as a politician or as a CEO, explain the transition. Is that also your experience, that like CEOs, leaders struggle with explaining what it will take and what the goals are and whatever? So how do you look at that? Like, because you also said we need to explain better what the goals are.
Yeah, for me, it goes back
are,
to leadership again. And that might sound like an open door, but maybe I can illustrate it by giving a very concrete example out of my own practice.
Yeah.
So you know that I've been a member of the executive committee of Royal Philips.
Mm-hmm.
And Royal Philips used to be a diversified industrial conglomerate, active in many industries. One of the industries
is
the lighting industry.
Yeah.
In the lighting industry, Philips, and that is where the company started with, was the global market leader.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a very clear commitment to sustainability in many aspects, and one of the aspects being the use of hazardous substances. And there is quite some regulation on the ban on the use of hazardous substances. And at a certain point in time in our sustainability board meetings, we had a discussion on how to deal with hazardous substances that were still part of conventional lighting, part of the product, that were within legal norms, but still hazardous substances. And my argument was, if we are a company that publicly states that we are there to improve the lives of 3 billion people a year by 2025, based upon everything we do, there is never a good reason to do the wrong thing. So the hazardous substances need to go out. And then the argument was, but we are competing with other companies that are not, let's say, as strict as we are. First of all, they might not be bound to the regulations that we are subject to. But secondarily, if they go by the letter of the law and we by the spirit of the law, then we have a competitive disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
And they even calculated what the competitive disadvantage meant in terms of cents per lamp.
And that's a good management accounting.
I know. Yeah. I mean, we translate everything into financial value. And my point was, that is true. But if you want to be a leader, and we always say that we are the leader in lighting worldwide, then you need to lead.
Mm-hmm.
And you might want to be the first that goes against the grain and say, we ban all hazardous substances, even beyond what we are legally obliged to do, and hope that others will follow. And maybe we might even create some preference with certain groups mm-hmm. of customers or the public opinion, but we need to do it.
Yeah.
Even if we will have to face that for a certain period of time, our cost price will be higher than that of competitors, and they might not follow, and it might lead to margin erosion, but we still need to do it.
Yeah.
It's very hard to substantiate that in traditional sense, because every accountant will say, well, I mean, our cost price is higher than it could be or should be, so that is a disadvantage. Legal people will say, well, you don't have an obligation to go beyond what is legally necessary. Marketing people might say, well, it's for me not so easy to market this sign of goodwill that we give by going beyond what we are legally obliged to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you still need leaders that then say, okay, but we still do it because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. But that is already like, I think this example is great. And what I really like is that at least in the discussion at Sustainability Committee, you made the trade-off clear, you know, okay, and we maybe give up some financial value, but this is like what we also find important, and we want to be a leader, we want to live up to this and this. And then at least the trade-off becomes clear, and you can have a more, I think, open discussion than what you sometimes see in some other firms, or also in the discussion about public transportation, for instance. It's like, yeah, it will cost us money, so we're not going to do it. I think that is, I think, what is really important, that our students and managers learn to make the trade-off clear. And that's maybe also why you need like management accountants to, you know, calculate it. Then at
we
least
do.
We know. And I think that is something, you see that in the better like the better performing firms when it comes to sustainability. It also enriches the discussion.
No, Bart, no question that is true. So, yeah. But as long as we realize that it's only the first step.
Yeah, of course.
You need to make it visible and transparent, and you need to allow for those trade-offs.
Yeah.
But then still people need to be willing and able to make trade-offs that are counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Because that's not the way we have been doing it in the past, because in the past, our main purpose was to increase earnings per share. And in that book, it fits to have the lowest possible cost price and the highest possible selling price.
Yeah.
And obviously, we need to stay within legal frameworks and boundaries. But the trade-offs help to make things transparent. But then still, you need leaders who take responsibility, who have the courage to go against the grain, explain it, and do it, and pull it through.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what then the decision was?
The decision was that we went with my recommendation.
Okay. Yeah. That's a very good example.
And we have seen that some of the bigger competitors followed.
Mm-hmm.
Because you set a standard. You create a new reality, which is one of the aspects of leadership, if you ask me. Leaders create new realities.
Yeah.
So you create new realities, made it easier for others to follow, and some didn't follow. So be it.
Okay. That's really a very good example. So, Ronald, in the second part of of this episode, I would like to talk with you about the course that you have set up here at Tilburg School of Economics and Management. And to give our listeners some context, I think you joined Tilburg University right before COVID, I think?
2017,
yeah. And very quickly, you started up to the conversation to set up a course which is called Global Sustainable Leadership. It's taught in the second year of our Bachelor International Business Administration. Could you just explain us what the aims are of this course? What do you want students to learn and to master at the end of this course?
A couple of things. First is to create more awareness for the big challenges that we face as society. Make also more clear that all actors in society have to step up to address them. And then zoom in on the role of business. And as we discussed in part one, if you as a business take responsibility for some of those challenges by embracing ESG or sustainability, then it has a profound impact on the way you run your business in terms of finance, accounting, supply chain management, but also marketing. So I wanted to make that clear. And the third thing is that I wanted to reinforce this point of leadership, because we are educating, hopefully, the next generation of leaders that will have to really make more progress towards a better world than the previous generations of leaders. So we need people who accelerate the transformations. Mm-hmm. And that's why I started this course. It's also tapping into, let's say, the interest of the younger generation that sees that we have climate change, that sees that there is social injustice and inequality and that is on the rise, that feels that we are living in times of change. And now we are preparing them to take a responsible role in society.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah. So what I like about this course, because I'm also teaching in this course, I'm teaching the accounting sessions. It's a multidisciplinary course.
Yeah.
Why a multidisciplinary course?
Yeah. Well, Bart, I think in accounting, a lot of things will have to change in order to make sure that accounting is a supporter and an enabler of really driving sustainability also in business.
Remains.
But that in itself is necessary but not sufficient. The challenges are so complex and multifaceted that you also need to bring those different perspectives in.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not only a finance issue. It's not only an accounting issue. That's why I said to you, yes, if we have the reporting and we have the measures and they are uniquely defined and we have no data integrity issues anymore and we have them at the tip of our fingertips, that's great, but it's only the start.
Yeah.
We need other things as well. And that's why I asked fellow professors to join in this effort and, mm-hmm. and say what they think is needed in their field of expertise to enable companies to become part of the solution. And that's why we call it also global sustainable leadership, because as I tried to make clear in the first part, I think everything is nice and dandy, but we need also a redefinition of leaders and business leadership to make sure that we drive the right changes.
Yeah,
and that's why we've set up the course.
Yeah. The course is in the second year of the bachelor.
Yeah.
Was it a conscious choice to position it in the second year of a bachelor? Was it, have you not thought about, well, we make it a mandatory course in all masters, or, you know, why the second year in the bachelor? And
The honest answer is that we looked at what was feasible. Mm-hmm. So trying something new is always difficult.
Yeah.
And we
will
come to talk about it in part three.
Yeah.
But leadership starts when somebody says no. Right. So it is hardly ever the case that if you have a new idea that people around you say, well, great, finally, how much money do you need and when can you start? That's never the case. Yeah. So when we had the idea of starting this course, I had an idea of having a mandatory course in for all first year students and then to make a master program and integrate it in every program we had. Well, that was a bridge too far, so we started more evolutionary, and we thought that it would be good to do it in the second year so that students are already have a certain basic understanding in each of those fields that we teach, each of those fields of expertise, but that they are still, let's say, in a phase where they are forming their own opinion on a variety of topics. It is not the end. So we are currently working on plans to also have further integration of the thinking in master programs and even might set up a master. I think it would be a good thing. Mm-hmm. Many our universities have masters in sustainable development, sustainable leadership, sustainable business. So I think... see it as a start of a process, and sometimes the first step is the most important one.
Yeah. I really like the expression, like, leadership starts when someone says no. I think that's definitely something to remember. So as already mentioned, I'm teaching in the course. I really like it. Students are really interested. The course is running for a couple of years now. I was happy to see that the course got the Social Impact Award of Tilburg University. I think that's really
very nice.
A good recognition for you, because I know this is difficult to change something in, let's say, well-established educational programs like a bachelor. It's not that easy to change something there. So based on your experience now, like, what does work well in the course? And where do you still see points for improvement? That could even be like points for improvement for the university administrators on how to be more flexible in adapting curricula or whatever. But maybe first, like, the good things. Yeah. What are the strong points of the course?
Yeah, great question. I think what we try to do resonates with students. So I see that they feel that there is a need for change. They are concerned when it comes to the future of the planet, and they really like the fact that we pay attention to that. So I think that is one. It resonates. Secondarily, it helps them to create a better and deeper understanding on what all of this means, because we often talk about concepts like sustainability and ESG and even leadership without really defining exactly what we mean with that, right? So I think deeper awareness. I think the third thing that is going well is that we spent quite some attention on the why we need this, given global challenges, what have you, the what, but also the how. And what I mean with that is that we made it a point to not only limit ourselves to lectures, but also have students work in teams on ideas for sustainable products or services or entire new businesses or business models, work together during a certain period of time, make a business plan, and then defend it in front of an what we call Dragon's Den, or in the United States, you have the famous program Shark Tank, where we invite also people from the outside world to challenge the students on their ideas and the bankability of their ideas and the feasibility of their ideas. So I think that goes well. What we could improve.
Because, and you can be very honest here about like everything. I think that's something all of us can learn about.
I tend to do that, Bart.
I
think I would like to see that the lectures are even more interactive. There are classes where it's really a monologue. So we transfer knowledge content. And that has to do with students. It also has to do with faculty. So how can we get that interaction going? Because this is a field in development and we need to co-develop. Mm-hmm. It's not that we as professors know exactly what the outcome should be and then we tell that to the students. No, it's also that we need the input from the younger generation and they need to challenge us and disagree with us and come up with their own ideas. And so I would like to have more dialogue on some of those big meaty topics. I think we need to broaden the curriculum further. So currently we work on finance, accounting, supply chain management, marketing, data management. But you refer to CSRD. There is a legal foundation underneath CSRD. We have a legal, we have a law school. Why don't we involve people from the law school? I talked with you in module one of this podcast about the resistance to change and how difficult it is to change behavior. Well, guess what? We have a faculty that deals with social change and behavioral change, the School of Humanities. So why don't we involve people from that school? And there I've seen, and you asked me to be honest and open, that collaboration between groups within the School of Economics and Management is one thing.
That's already difficult.
But it's a challenge.
I have to say, you managed. You did a really good job. I think many people tried it before you, but were not like at least as successful as in this course. So I think that's definitely good, but it's indeed difficult.
Well, we need to, thanks for that, but we need to leverage all of the capabilities and pockets of excellence at Tilburg University and to give the best possible experience to our students, right? So I know personally of people in the professors in the law school and in the School of Humanities that I would love to have being part of the faculty. They would love to be part of it as well. So that might be a point for further improvement and enhancement.
What is creating the resistance or making it difficult to not do that? Because I remember when we were setting up the course, you contacted different professors from different fields, and I think at least nearly all of them immediately said yes.
Absolutely.
Without thinking about, at least that's how I see it, about the incentives. Like, do I get time to teach those two sessions, blah, blah, blah. And I think it was a very clever choice to, let's say, okay, every professor gives two sessions because this is something...
It's overseeable.
Yeah.
I need to be critical to myself here, Bart. I think that it is about time to make the move beyond TISM and really include the other, faculties into the program. I don't foresee big resistance. It is just that we started with TISM and we are improving, and it's maybe that we are suffering from incrementalism and that this podcast also helps me to really pick up the glove again and say we are going to do that for the next edition.
Maybe after this podcast, people will just contact you.
Could be. I have another, challenging, maybe provocative point that I want to make. And that is that I really feel that when it comes to sustainability and ESG and innovation in the way we do business, that is not only by pulling together a couple of people from different schools of thought and make them work together. That's one. The other thing is, and I think you are, to give a compliment to you, an example of somebody who does that, you also need to critically evaluate the way you look at your own field of expertise. And for instance, I'm working in the marketing department, and I say to my fellow marketing colleagues, you are world class. When I look at academic publications, Tilburg University is really at the top of the list. Do you realize the responsibility that goes with that? If marketing is a discipline that influences the behavior of consumers, you can influence it for good and for bad. So how much time and effort do we invest also in our research in reinvestigating how we can make marketing into a force for good, in driving behaviors in a way that they will help to address the big challenges of our time, like healthy consumption of food or whatever, you know? So the innovation that needs to take place in finance, in accounting, in marketing, in data management, in all of those fields is also something that needs to have more attention in my view. Too often I see colleagues that have been educated in models and theories and concepts and constructs, and they keep teaching those same constructs for decades. I mean, when I came back to university as a professor of practice, I saw some of my colleagues teaching the same stuff that I was taught when I did my master's, and I can assure you that's a long time ago. So, and there is nothing wrong with the fundamentals, but the world is changing so fast. So also, it's not only by bringing all those disciplines together that something new arises. Also in your own discipline, you need to innovate.
I think, of course, there are the incentives in academia when it comes to tenure and promotion. I think that is not really helping, although things are changing there too. Like here we have the rewards and recognition program. What really helps me to, in a way, be aware, because I think it's also a problem of be aware what the problems are that practice is really running into your specific field. Could be marketing, finance, whatever. And going, what really helps me to be aware of what CFOs are struggling with is going to a couple of times per year. You start with once per year, you go to a practitioner conference. Like I typically go to the CFO top in Belgium. And there, you know, you get a good view on what CFOs struggle with. And these days, it's a lot about sustainability. It's a lot about artificial intelligence and the interaction, the overlap between that. And then, you know, you start to talk with some of the people there. And they ask you, like, what are you doing? And they are pretty direct. They say, yeah, that's not like... that's not a problem for us. Sometimes they say, "Well, that's really nice. Can we keep up the interaction or can whatever?" I think that really helps, at least it helps me to ask questions that I think like, okay, they could be of any practical relevance. Okay.
Sure.
And I think that could really, you know, in the beginning.
You take the initiative and there would show the leadership to reach out, to test your own assumptions, to solicit feedback on what you do, ask for input, you look for that. I think that is commendable. And I think that should be an example for all professors.
I think we are changing into that, but maybe as in every organization, we need to change more there. Okay. So other points for improvement in, I think that you experienced in like when you implemented this course and thought like, okay, if this could change in university.
I went probably one step too far in the design of the course. And that is that when we said we don't want to limit it to lectures. We also want students to work on skills and competencies like work in teams, convince each other, collaborate, but also effectively present their ideas on sustainable business and products and services. I think that was a good step because as a university, we have the ambition to weave minds and characters. So we also need to work on the character part. But I had a further ambition, and that is that some of those ideas we turn into reality. And my wife and I are financial supporters of the University Fund. And via the University Fund, we made available money as seed funding for some of those plans of students. And so far, we haven't seen the next Uber, Facebook or Google yet. As a matter of fact, you see that students are under a lot of pressure to go through their exams and gather their points and graduate and then move on, which I understand. My ambition would still be, if you look at some of the most innovative companies that we have seen in the last decades, many of them originated from university campuses. And my ambition would be that we also really encourage our students to step up the plate and not only learn about these type of things and apply it in academic work, but try to turn it into reality and into new businesses that help to make progress towards those goals, you know? And that we didn't succeed in yet. So we need to find a way to do that better.
Is that because students don't have time for it? Because they have, indeed, they need to study, but they also need to work because they need to, let's say, you know, they need money for living.
I think that those are all reasons why not. But I told you before, leadership starts when you say no. Yeah. So those are all reasons why not. But if we still think that it would be a great idea if something would originate from Tilburg University, we need to find a way to make it possible anyway, right?
So that's something we can work on. So maybe one question to you, like what I, like if you want to start something new in a university, in your case, a new multidisciplinary course, you have to deal with like a lot of procedures. And even those procedures, they sometimes stop you off trying to innovate. You know, like you want to set up a new master that is really tailoring to the needs of what firms and organizations and society needs today. And then, you know, you have to like a lot of accreditations. It takes you 2 years, blah, blah, blah. And then on the other hand, you get like the complaint from practice, like, well, you don't teach them what we need. My answer is often like, well, to some extent you're right, but if you see how many procedures we have to go through to change something, you know, that is not really motivating. How do you look at that?
Well, the way
having
I see
worked
that, Bart,
in like a big organization,
I see a nice parallel with the previous discussion. I think you need to teach them what they need, and you need to do that excellent. That gives you the rite of passage, and it also gives you the latitude to sometimes do things for which you afterwards ask for forgiveness instead of asking for permission up front. If you don't have the basics in place and you start to experiment with all types of stuff, you will have a short career, whether it's in academics or in business. I have seen that people got away with a lot of stuff once they had their house on order and the fundamentals in place and they were able to perform. And then you build credibility and trust and, and respect and, and sympathy. And then sometimes you can say, oh, I didn't know that. Sorry. But by the way, it was successful. I was part of that as well. You know?
Okay.
So get your house in order. Make sure that you do what is expected from you as a minimum. But as leaders, you create new realities and you cannot expect that everybody will be there to support you. So sometimes you just need to do it and hopefully you are successful in what you do. And then you will see that you have a lot of supporters and people who said, I said it all the time.
Okay.
He that's only did what I said already 5 years ago.
Yeah. Wait, that's good. That's really like good advice to change things. So for the last part, Ronald, I would like to talk to you about your boardroom experience. You have been a member of the executive committee of Philips for quite some years. When you entered there, you already had like already a long career in Philips. Like, what surprised you in how decisions are made in the boardroom that you didn't expect before you entered?
More things surprised me, and they surprised me more severely than I anticipated, to be quite honest.
Okay.
Let me mention three things in random order. Yeah. They are equally important. The first thing that I really underestimated is that the moment you are appointed in the board of a big organization, you are basically being put under a magnifying glass.
Yeah.
And that means that everything you do, everything you say, everything you don't do, everything you don't say, how you do it, how you say it, is being interpreted, is being amplified, is being magnified, triggers its own dynamic. And you sometimes don't realize, especially when you are just appointed, what the impact is of your behavior on individual people. So I think the fact that you have a profound impact on how you make people feel based upon your interaction with them and how that basically resonates with the rest of the organization is far beyond what you anticipated when you get into that role. Because for you, it's just, yeah, you have now more work and more responsibility, but you're still the same person. For other people, it's a different ballgame.
So is all that of like a sudden, entering the building and not saying hello to someone you cross?
It is more that if you tend to be, for instance, very constructive, critical in your dialogues, there is a difference between saying to a colleague, I don't think you went deep enough in your analysis or you didn't prepare well enough for this meeting. If it comes from a board member, it has profound implications for the way people experience that. Mm. And sometimes you just don't realize that. Yeah? So I think, and that goes, the good thing is, it also goes in the positive way. So if you encourage people, if you praise people, you will give them wings.
Okay.
Yeah, and you don't realize that before you get elevated to that board. The second thing that that I really underestimated, is you get unfiltered exposure to all kinds of information on business reality, strategic threats, opportunities, upcoming reorganization, shareholder value activism, personal threats and security, what have you. You didn't have that before. You were shielded off of certain critical informations. And if you are a very open person, and I like to believe that I am a very open person, I always discussed with my team the things that were happening in my department and in the company and how I looked at that. But you're a member of the board and you know that you take a strategic decision, for instance, on the portfolio of the company or you plan an acquisition or you are forced to do a big restructuring. You cannot talk with anybody about that.
Yeah.
And that makes you very lonely. Yeah. So and you need to build in a certain distance. And that is difficult because I worked already for more than 20 years for the company when I got promoted to the board. So many people that knew me knew that I was a very open guy. And all of a sudden, I was less open because I couldn't be open.
Yeah.
And I also couldn't share it with my fellow board members because we were all too damn busy, you know? So everybody is minding his field of responsibility or her field of responsibility, incredibly busy, traveling the world, a lot of pressure, 24/7. So you are alone with those thoughts and with that information. You need to digest it. You cannot share it with friends. You cannot share it with your team. You cannot really share it with your colleagues because of practicalities. Yeah. So that is the second thing.
Because I find it a very interesting one. I think it was the second episode we had Erwin van Latem here, who has been CEO of Ascent, also like a big Dutch company, Dutch German company. He said something very similar, and he also concluded with it's sometimes lonely at the top. Yeah. Deal with that? You cannot share all information. You have to digest it yourself. Means sometimes you have to make your own decisions because you cannot share whatever.
A very stable home front. You need to have very good friends, and you need to be your own best friend. If that is not the case, then it becomes more difficult.
Yeah.
And it is not without a reason that you see many people at the top starting to show extreme behaviors. Eh? I mean, the people who just tend to drink too much or even more excessive habits. Yeah. And the pressure is high. Yeah? Yeah. And it is lonely. It is lonely. I mean, it's an open door. It's lonely at the door. But it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Okay. Third one.
The third one is that when you get promoted, I mean, we are all human beings, right? So what is your first emotion is that you are honored, right? I mean, you achieve something. And we have a society in which achievement is valued, and it feels good. You work hard, you achieve something. And that is being replaced very quickly with a tremendous sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
So you really realize, that's another open door in leadership, that the buck stops with you. If you are a member of a department or member of a division management, there's always somebody else who finally calls the shots, takes the responsibility. But if we had a board meeting in which we decided that we would IPO the lighting business, which we did, we, at that moment in time, and nobody else, takes the responsibility of separating a unit that started the company more than 100 years ago. And we do that, nobody else. And also when you have to let people go, or when you do acquisitions and you spend a lot of company money investing in an acquisition. So the tremendous sense of, what did we just decide?
Yeah.
Oh, we just decided that with that IPO, tens of thousands of employees that are very proud of working for Philips and sometimes for generations are now going to work for an independent company.
Yeah. And in combination with like the fact that everything you do and don't do and say and decide is amplified, the fact that, you know, you have to sometimes deal with the information on your own, like you make that decision, you cannot immediately, you maybe want to share, you know, that decision already, some information to, you know, to get some feedback, it's impossible. I think the third one becomes even, becomes really challenging.
Those were the three main things.
Yeah. So that's I think thank you for being so open. How do you because everything is amplified, part of it in the organization, but as a as one of the executives in a listed firm, you're also followed by like newspapers, journalists, all these type of websites these days.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing.
How do you deal with that? You
become more suspicious. So. Yeah. Every email that I send, I know will be could end up in the hands of people that are not supposed to read those mails. So you are aware of that. You also are aware that everything you say or state is being saved somewhere in the digital day and age. So you become more careful, a bit suspicious, but also more careful. You don't say things that you would not repeat in public again. You won't write things that you won't, write under normal circumstances. So, and in lower levels in the organization, sometimes emotions take over. People say things that they regret, and the penalties of making those type of mistakes could be catastrophic. When you are in the public, think about forward-looking statements. And I can assure you, I've been in many news shows, CNBC and CNN, and then we opened a new facility in India, and you get CNBC, and they say, you're about to release earnings in the third quarter, how things are going, and this and the other. I mean, so. And you can do media training, and we all get media training, but you need to have a kind of baked-in caution. What you say, how you say it.
What you don't say.
What you don't say,
So I think this will definitely help our students, but also our listeners in general. Like, what does it mean to be an executive committee? But if you talk with students, where do you think they have a biased view regarding what it means to be like a CEO, an executive member, whatever?
If they have the same bias that I used to have, then they might overestimate the power that people in office have.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I say that? When I was just when I just left university, started to work for Philips, I look at the board of management. I thought, those guys are calling all the shots. I mean, they just have to say, we do this and we go that way. We do this, we do that way. I would argue that the board is more dependent upon the organization than that the organization is dependent upon the board.
Mm-hmm.
So the power of individual board members and of the board as such is very often overestimated. I think the power of the organization is much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so important to get the organization in the right direction.
Yeah.
The second thing is that power is a concept that is wrong, is a misnomer, is wrong in the first place. Power is probably the worst tool of management there is. Power erodes.
Okay.
The more you use it, the more you lose it. So you should not manage based upon power. You don't have it in the first place, which you thought you would have when you would be appointed to the board or as CEO. But secondarily, you need to build authority. Yeah. You need to manage based upon influence. People need to respect you, trust you. Sympathy helps. Very often underestimated in business. Mm-hmm. Sympathy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think what the bias that people have is those people, they have the power and they can decide what happens. They are looking at the organization. They see 80,000, 100,000, 200,000 people. People in the organization look at the board, they see 10 people, 13 people. I mean, the power is with the organization. And mm-hmm. secondarily, power is the worst tool of management you can apply. So I think that is a big source of bias. The second thing is that people always think, well, we have this board meeting, and in the board meeting it was decided that we would this, that, and the other. The boardroom and board meetings are just one of the things in the total, let's say, process. The most important things happen outside of the boardroom, before board meetings and after board meetings. Yeah. That's where you try to find support for your ideas. That's why you try to form coalitions. That's where you with validate other, your ideas.
With other board members or also?
With other board members, with the CEO. You want to know the lay of the land, who is in favor, who is against, what are the arguments. And that helps you to also make sure that when you have a slot in a board to make your point, mm-hmm. that you come with a balanced story, taking into account the arguments, the counter-arguments, the concerns, the fears, yeah? and try to address that in a compelling way so that you get support for your point. And then if the board supports and endorses that, then that's the consequence of what you did before the board meeting. But then only the work starts.
Yeah.
Because then you think, well, now I have my decision. So what? I very often, I will give you this anecdote. It's very nice. When I was a young executive, mm-hmm. yeah, one of my first executive roles, I had to take a difficult decision in the field of logistics in the European, on the European continent. We needed to close warehouses and go to central warehouses. And I went to the board and I said, I need a mandate. And the CEO said, you have the mandate. And then I walked out of the boardroom. I thought,
oh,
and now, I still need to convince all those people that will have to close their warehouse and transfer to a central. So the work is not in the boardroom. It's before and after,
Yeah. It's like a little bit, you want a mandate because you maybe still have that bias too, that power is
exactly.
Everything what it is.
That's why I said I was a young executive. Yeah. I mean, later I didn't ask for mandates anymore, you know?
So maybe to close this this part, like what did you, because you really talk passionate about your time in the boardroom. No, they're also like it's also it's struggling. What did you learn in the boardroom that you would not have learned if you would not have that about 10 years in the boardroom?
Well, that at the end of the day, it's all about the personal leadership effectiveness.
Yeah,
and the effectiveness doesn't come by saying that they need to change.
Yeah, right?
You very often see that marketing says to sales. We have a good value proposition, you cannot sell it. And sales said, well, we can sell it, but manufacturing cannot produce it. So you need to change. Nothing happens if you stick to they need to change. Well, sometimes you have a better atmosphere and you come to the conclusion that we need to change.
Mm-hmm.
Then also doesn't have effect or impact.
Yeah.
The only impact happens if you realize that you need to change, that you need to take responsibility, that you need to create new realities, that you need to get support for your ideas, and that you need to get people behind you to operationalize them. That's what I learned.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very valuable lesson next to all the other valuable lessons we had in this part. So Ronald, you you told me that you you listened to some of the other episodes, so you know how we close this one. It's the you know, we ask our guests to name a song, book, movie, painting, whatever. Tell the story of that song, book, movie, painting. So what is your choice?
This was the most difficult part of the podcast, and that's partly the result of the fact that I have a broad interest when it comes to art and to literature and to music. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to pick one.
I was already expecting that you would, if you would have an interest in sports or soccer, you would have like the club song of PSV. But that's you told me before the podcast that that will not be the case. But yeah,
no,
I'm curious.
No. I think I would have a hard time, Bart, to come up with one book. There are many books that influenced me, or one song, or one piece of art. I think you need to look at the beauty in all of those things. Mm-hmm. And what tends to attract me most is things that are pure, and where you see passion. Mm-hmm. If you have a good song, you see the raw talent of people. Mm-hmm. I very often like singers that sing without a big orchestra, without digital remastering, without, you know, just they sing their song. Yeah, and there are many examples of that. And yeah, I don't want to mention all of them because there are many. It's the same goes for art. Very often, the pureness in art is what touches me. And what then really also inspires me and sometimes, let's say, also makes me a little bit emotional. I'm always looking for passion. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for authenticity. And that goes for art, music. It goes for books, literature. But above all, it goes for people. Mm-hmm. If you have real people,
yeah,
people that don't play a role but are who they are, in the essence, then that tends to strike me. And I also see that in authors, I see that in painters, mm-hmm, I see that in magicians.
Okay.
So I guess that is the best answer I can give to you.
Still, I would like to push you and maybe I'm going to push you on a painting and art, because nearly nobody here has brought that up. Like, what is a painter or in that side that we have to look at, that you say, well, no, this is someone I advise you to look at it. It's pure. It's passion.
Well, for me, Vincent van Gogh is somebody who always turns tears on my eyes.
Yeah.
But I think it has a lot to do with the tragedy.
Yeah.
And in all honesty, you force me. That's why it's a great question, Bart.
Yeah.
Also in music, I tend to favor artists that have that generous in them,
mm-hmm,
but at the same time are very often very tragic.
Yeah.
That intrigues me. Yeah. I don't know really why that is. Yeah. I might need another life to find out. But
okay,
there's something in that combination of people that are genius and at the same time are tragic.
Yeah. Okay, Vincent van Gogh, I think many people know him, will know him, many listeners, and I actually hope everybody knows the name, but I think it's definitely valuable to look back at also at his history and what happened in his life. And if you visit all the places where he stayed, you'll have like a nice trip through Europe. So that's
but maybe, I mean, again, you're really helping me with this question, because if I reflect upon your last question and the entire podcast, it might have something to do with the fact that if you really want to do something magnificent, you might not get the recognition in your lifetime. You know, and some of those people pay a high price for being front runners,
mm-hmm,
being new, being innovative, doing things differently.
Yeah.
And even paid the price that we said in the beginning of the podcast, we are not willing to pay a price.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, they change the world of art, or they change the world of music.
Yeah.
So we might want to see the same type of things in the rest of society,
yeah,
where people go a certain way. And they get criticism and people don't understand them. And but at the end of the day, what they do might be very significant in view of, mm-hmm, let's say, impacting the world and the lives of other people. That might be the common denominator. Yeah. Well, thanks for helping me.
We are not yet
progressing
there
on the thinking.
Like one last question. So this is also a lot of our listeners are students. You already gave many pieces of advice. Like what would be your number one advice for our students?
Yeah. You know, when I did my inaugural address almost 6 years ago, I formulated 10 leadership lessons. And some of them have percolated into this podcast as well, implicitly. But the most important leadership lesson was the 10th, the last lesson. And that was, forget all the 9 that I just mentioned and develop your own wisdom.
Yeah.
And I think we really need people who dare to challenge their own conventional beliefs, but also that of others, including ours, part as professors.
Of course.
Develop their own wisdom, follow their own legend, create new realities, go new routes, because that is what the world will need, given the profound issues and problems and challenges that we are facing today.
Yeah.
We need authentic thinkers, strong thinkers, that follow their own route.
Yeah.
And I think that is the best lesson that I can give. Take note of what I say, what you say, and read all those books and go to the museum and look at the paintings of Van Gogh, but then make your own distillate.
Yeah.
Because Van Gogh didn't copy anybody.
That's true.
Yeah, that's why we remember him. So don't try to be good at what other people told you. Take the important things out and then develop your own wisdom. That's the most important lesson.
Yeah, I think I cannot agree more. And I think we can just close it here. Ronald, I would like to thank you for this podcast. It was a very good one, inspirational one. I'm pretty sure you will at some point come back in the podcast. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, and thanks again for helping me to progress on some of my own thinking. Thank you.
The podcast made impact. Thank you.